Goldfinger by Ian Fleming, continued. Disc 5.
I'm playing golf. There's the Swiss Women's Open Championship at Divonne. I'm not really that class, but I thought it would be good for me to try. Then I was going to play on some of the other courses.
Fair enough. No reason why it shouldn't be true. But Bond was certain it wasn't the whole truth. He said, "Do you play a lot of golf? What's your home course?"
"Quite a lot. Temple."
It had been an obvious question. Was the answer true, or just the first golf course she had thought of? "Do you live near there?"
"I've got an aunt who lives at Henley. What are you doing in Switzerland? Holiday?"
"Business. Import and export."
"Oh."
Bond smiled to himself. It was a stage conversation. The voices were polite stage voices. He could see the scene, beloved of the English theatre, the drawing room, sunshine on hollyhocks outside French windows, the couple sitting on the sofa, on the edge of it, she pouring out the tea. "Do you take sugar?" They came out into the foothills. There was a long, straight stretch of road, and in the distance the small group of buildings of the French customs. The girl gave him no chance to get a glimpse of her passport. As soon as the car stopped, she said something about tidying up and disappeared into the dame. Bond had gone through the control, and was dealing with the triptyque when she reappeared, her passport stamped. At the Swiss customs, she chose the excuse of getting something out of her suitcase. Bond hadn't got time to hang about and call her bluff. Bond hurried on into Geneva and pulled up at the imposing entrance of the Berg. The bagagiste took her suitcase and golf clubs. They stood together on the steps. She held out her hand.
"Goodbye."
There was no melting of the candid blue eyes.
"And thank you. You drive beautifully."
Her mouth smiled.
"I'm surprised you got into the wrong gear at Macon."
Bond shrugged. "It doesn't often happen. I'm glad I did. If I can get my business finished, perhaps we could meet again."
"That would be nice."
The tone of voice said it wouldn't be. The girl turned and went in through the swing doors. Bond ran down to his car. To hell with her. Now to pick up Goldfinger. Then to the little office on the Quai Wilson. He tuned the Homer and waited a couple of minutes. Goldfinger was close, but moving away. He could either be following the right or the left bank of the lake. From the pitch of the Homer, he was at least a mile outside the town. Which way? To the left, towards Lausanne? To the right, towards Evian? The DB3 was already on the left-hand road. Bond decided to follow its nose. He got moving. Bond caught up with the high yellow silhouette just before Coppet, the tiny lakeside hamlet made famous by Madame de Stael. He hid behind a lorry. At his next reconnaissance, the rolls had disappeared. Bond motored on, watching to the left. At the entrance to the village, big, solid iron gates were closing in a high wall. Dust hung in the air. Above the wall was a modest placard. It said, in faded yellow on blue, "Enterprises Auric A.G." The fox had gone to earth. Bond went on until he found a turning to the left. He followed this until there was a lane which led back through the vineyards to the woods behind Coppet and to the chateau of Madame de Stael. Bond stopped among the trees. Now he should be directly above the Enterprises Auric. He took his binoculars, got out, and followed a footpath down towards the village. Soon, on his right, was a spiked iron railing. There was rolled barbed wire along its top. 100 yards lower down the hill, the railing merged into a high stone wall. Bond walked slowly back up the path, looking for the secret entrance the children of Coppet would have made to get at the chestnut trees. He found it. 2 bars of the railing widened to allow a small boy through. Bond stood on the lower railing with all his weight, widened the gap by another couple of inches, and wormed his way through. Bond walked warily through the trees, watching each step for dead branches. The trees thinned. There were glimpses of a huddle of low buildings behind a small manoir. Bond picked the thick trunk of a fir tree and got behind it. Now he was looking down on the buildings. The nearest was about 100 yards away. There was an open courtyard. In the middle of the courtyard stood the dusty silver ghost. Bond took out the binoculars and examined everything minutely. The house was a well-proportioned square block of old red brick with a slate roof. It consisted of 2 stories and an attic floor. It would probably contain 4 bedrooms and 2 principal rooms. The walls were partly covered by a very old wisteria in full bloom. It was an attractive house. In his mind's eye, Bond could see the white painted panelling inside. He smelled the sweet, musty, sunshiny smell of the rooms. The back door gave onto the wide, paved courtyard in which stood the rolls. The courtyard was open on Bond's side, but closed on the other two sides by single-story corrugated iron workshops. A tall zinc chimney rose from the angle of the two workshops. The chimney was topped by a zinc cowl. On top of the zinc cowl was the revolving square mouth of what looked to Bond like a Decca radar scanner you see on the bridges of most ships. The apparatus whirled steadily round. Bond couldn't imagine what purpose it served on the roof of this little factory among the trees. Suddenly the silence and immobility of the peaceful scene were broken. It was as if Bond had put a penny in the slot of a diorama on Brighton Pier. Somewhere a tinny clock struck five. At the signal, the back door of the house opened and Goldfinger came out, still dressed in his white linen motoring coat but without the helmet. He was followed by a nondescript, obsequious little man with a toothbrush moustache and horn-rimmed spectacles. Goldfinger looked pleased. He went up to the rolls and patted its bonnet. The other man laughed politely. He took a whistle out of his waistcoat pocket and blew it. A door in the right-hand workshop opened, and four workmen in blue overalls filed out and walked over to the car. From the open door they had left, there came a whirring noise, and a heavy engine started up and settled into the rhythmic pant Bond remembered from Reculver. The four men disposed themselves round the car. At a word from the little man, who was presumably the foreman, they began to take the car to pieces. By the time they had lifted the four doors off their hinges, removed the bonnet cover from the engine, and had set about the rivets on one of the mudguards, it was clear that they were methodically stripping the car of its armour plating. Almost as soon as Bond had come to this conclusion, the black, bowler-hatted figure of Oddjob appeared at the back door of the house and made some sort of a noise at Goldfinger. With a word to the foreman, Goldfinger went indoors and left the workmen to it. It was time for Bond to get going. He took a last careful look round to fix the geography in his mind and edged back among the trees. "I'm from Universal Export."
Yes?"
Behind the desk there was a reproduction of the Anagoni portrait of the Queen. On the other walls were advertisements for Ferguson tractors and other agricultural machinery. From outside the wide window came the hum of traffic along the Quai Wilson. A steamer hooted. Bond glanced out of the window and watched it ride across the middle distance. It left an enchanted wake across the flawless evening mirror of the lake. Bond looked back into the politely inquiring eyes in the bland, neutral businessman's face.
"We were hoping to do business with you."
"What sort of business?"
"Important business."
The man's face broke into a smile. He said cheerfully,
"It's 007, isn't it? Thought I recognised you. Well now, what can I do for you?"
The voice became cautious. "Only one thing. Better make it quick and get along. There's been the hell of a heat on since the Dumont business. They've got me taped, the locals and Redland. All very peaceful, of course, but you won't want them sniffing round you."
"I thought it might be like that. It's only routine. Here."
Bond unbuttoned his shirt and took out the heavy chunk of gold. "Get that back, would you? And transmit this when you have a chance." The man pulled a pad towards him and wrote in shorthand to Bond's dictation. When the man had finished, he put the pad in his pocket.
"Well, well, pretty hot stuff. Wilco, my routine's at midnight. This..." he indicated the gold, "can go to Bairn for the bag. Anything else?"
"Never heard of the Enterprises Auric at Coppet. Know what they do?"
"I know what every engineering business in the area does. Have to. Try to sell them some hand riveters last year. They make metal furniture, pretty good stuff. The Swiss railways take some of it, and the airlines."
"Know which airlines?"
The man shrugged.
"I heard they did all the work for Mecca, the big charter line to India. Their terminus is Geneva. They're quite a big competitor with All India. Mecca's privately owned. Matter of fact, I did hear that Auric & Co. had some money in it. No wonder they've got the contract for the seating."
A slow, grim smile spread across Bond's face. He got up and held out his hand.
"You don't know it, but you've just done a whole jigsaw puzzle in under a minute. Many thanks. Best of luck with the tractor business. Hope we'll meet again one day."
Out in the street, Bond got quickly into his car and drove along the quay to the Berg. So that was the picture. For 2 days he'd been trailing a silver ghost across Europe. It was an armour-plated silver ghost. He'd watched the last bit of plating being riveted on in Kent, and the whole lot being stripped off at Coppet. Those sheets would already be in the furnaces at Coppet, ready to be modelled into 70 chairs for a Mecca constellation. In a few days' time, those chairs would be stripped off the plane in India and replaced with aluminium ones. And Goldfinger would have made what? £500,000? £1,000,000? For the silver ghost wasn't silver at all. It was a golden ghost, all the 2 tons of its bodywork, solid 18-carat white gold. Chapter 14. Things That Go Thump in the Night. James Bond booked in at the Hotel de Berg, took a bath and shower and changed his clothes. He weighed the Walter PPK in his hand and wondered whether he should take it or leave it behind. He decided to leave it. He had no intention of being seen when he went back to the Enterprise's Oryk. If, by dreadful luck, he was seen, it would spoil everything to get into a fight. He had his story, a poor one, but at least one that would not break his cover. He would have to rely on that. But Bond did choose a particular pair of shoes that were rather heavier than one could expect from their casual build. At the desk he asked if Miss Soames was in. He was not surprised when the receptionist said they had no Miss Soames staying in the hotel. The only question was whether she had left the hotel when Bond was out of sight, or had registered under another name. Bond motored across the beautiful Pont du Mont Blanc, and along the brightly lit quay to the Bavaria, a modest Alsatian brasserie that had been the rendezvous of the great in the days of the League of Nations. He sat by the window and drank Enzian, washed down with pale Löwenbräu. He thought first about Goldfinger. There was now no doubt what he was up to. He financed a spy network, probably Smash, and he made fortunes smuggling gold to India, the country where he could get the biggest premium. After the loss of his Brixham trawler, he had thought out this new way. He first made it known that he had an armoured car. That would only be considered eccentric. Many English bodybuilders exported them. They used to go to Indian Rajas. Now they went to oil sheikhs and South American presidents. Goldfinger had chosen a silver ghost because, with his modifications, the chassis was strong enough, the riveting was already a feature of the bodywork, and there was the largest possible area of metal sheeting. Perhaps Goldfinger had run it abroad once or twice to get Ferryfield used to it. Then, on the next trip, he took off the armour plating in his works at Reculver. He substituted 18-carat white gold. Its alloy of nickel and silver would be strong enough. The colour of the metal would not betray him if he got in a smash or if the bodywork were scratched. Then off to Switzerland and to the little factory. The workmen would have been as carefully picked as the ones at Reculver. They would take off the plates and mould them into aircraft seats, which would then be upholstered and installed in Mecca Airlines, run presumably by some stooge of Goldfinger's who got a cut on each gold run. On these runs, once, twice, 3 times a year, the plane would accept only light freight and a few passengers. At Bombay or Calcutta, the plane would need an overhaul, be re-equipped. It would go to the Mecca hangar and have new seats fitted. The old ones, the gold ones, would go to the bullion brokers. Goldfinger would get his sterling credit in Nassau or wherever he chose. He would have made his 100% or 200% profit and could start the cycle all over again from the We Buy Old Gold shops in Britain to Reculver, Geneva, Bombay. Yes, thought Bond, gazing out across the glistening, starlit lake. That's how it would be. A top-notch smuggling circuit with a minimum risk and maximum profit. How Goldfinger must smile as he pressed the bulb of the old boa constrictor horn and swept past the admiring policemen of 3 countries. He certainly seemed to have the answer, the philosopher's stone, the finger of gold. If he hadn't been such an unpleasant man, if he wasn't doing all this to sustain the trigger finger of Smash, Bond would have felt admiration for this monumental trickster, whose operations were so big that they worried even the Bank of England. As it was, Bond only wanted to destroy Goldfinger, seize his gold, get him behind bars. Goldfinger's gold lust was too strong, too ruthless, too dangerous to be allowed the run of the world. It was 8 o'clock. The Enzian, the fire water distilled from gentian that is responsible for Switzerland's chronic alcoholism, was beginning to warm Bond's stomach and melt his tensions. He ordered another double, and with it a choucroute and a carafe of fondant. And what about the girl, this pretty authoritarian joker that had suddenly been faced in the deal? What in hell was she about? What about this golf story? Bond got up and went to the telephone booth at the back of the room. He got on to the Journal de Genève and through to the sports editor. The man was helpful, but surprised at Bond's question. No, the various championships were, of course, played in the summer, when the other national programmes were finished, and it was possible to lure a good foreign entry to Switzerland. It was the same with all other European countries. They liked to bring in as many British and American players as possible. It increased the gates. Pas de quoi, monsieur. Bond went back to his table and ate his dinner. So much for that. Whoever she was an amateur. No professional would use a cover that could be broken down by one telephone call. It had been in the back of Bond's mind, reluctantly, because he liked the girl and was excited by her, that she just could have been an agent of Smash, sent to keep an eye on Goldfinger, or Bond, or both. She had some of the qualities of a secret agent, the independence, the strength of character, the ability to walk alone. But that idea was out. She hadn't got the training. Bond ordered a slice of Gruyere, pumpernickel, and coffee. No, she was an enigma. Bond only prayed that she hadn't got some private plot involving either him or Goldfinger that was going to mess up his own operation. And his own job was so nearly finished. All he needed was the evidence of his own eyes that the story he had woven round Goldfinger and the Rolls was the truth. One look into the works at Coppet, one grain of white gold dust, and he could be off to Bern that very night and be on to the duty officer over the embassy scrambler. Then, quietly, discreetly, the Bank of England would freeze Goldfinger's accounts all over the world, and perhaps, already tomorrow, the special branch of the Swiss police would be knocking on the door of Enterprises Oric. Extradition would follow, Goldfinger would go to Brixton. There would be a quiet, rather complicated case in one of the smuggling courts like Maidstone or Lewis. Goldfinger would get a few years, his naturalisation would be revoked, and his gold hoard, illegally exported, would trickle back into the vaults below the Bank of England. And Smersh would gnash its blood-stained teeth and add another page to Bond's bulging zapiska. Time to go for the last lap. Bond paid his bill and went out and got into his car. He crossed the Rhone and motored slowly along the glittering quay through the evening traffic. It was an average night for his purpose. There was a blazing three-quarter moon to see by, but not a breath of wind to hide his approach through the woods to the factory. Well, there was no hurry. They would probably be working through the night. He would have to take it very easily and carefully. The geography of the place and the route he had plotted for himself ran before Bond's eyes like a film, while the automatic pilot that is in all good drivers took the car along the wide, white highway beside the sleeping lake. Bond followed his route of the afternoon. When he had turned off the main road, he drove on his sidelights. He nosed the car off the lane into a clearing in the woods and switched off the engine. He sat and listened. In the heavy silence there was only a soft ticking from the hot metal under the bonnet and the hasty trip of the dashboard clock. Bond got out, eased the door shut, and walked softly down the little path through the trees. Now he could hear the soft, heavy pant of the generator engine, thumpa, thumpa, thumpa. It seemed a watchful, rather threatening noise. Bond reached the gap in the iron bars, slipped through and stood, straining his senses forward through the moon-dappled trees. Thumpa, thumpa, thumpa. The great iron puffs were on top of him, inside his brain. Bond felt the skin-crawling tickle at the groin that dates from one's first game of hide-and-seek in the dark. He smiled to himself at the animal danger signal. What primeval chord had been struck by this innocent engine noise coming out of the tall zinc chimney? The breath of a dinosaur in its cave? Bond tightened his muscles and crept forward foot by foot, moving small branches carefully out of his way, placing each step as cautiously as if he was going through a minefield. The trees were thinning. Soon he would be up with the big sheltering trunk he had used before. He looked for it, and then stood frozen, his pulse racing. Below the trunk of his tree, spread-eagled on the ground, was a body. Bond opened his mouth wide and breathed slowly in and out to release the tension. Softly he wiped his sweating palms down his trousers. He dropped slowly to his hands and knees and stared forward. His eyes widened like camera lenses. The body under the tree moved, shifted cautiously to a new position. A breath of wind whispered in the tops of the trees. The moonbeams danced quickly across the body and then were still. There was a glimpse of thick black hair, black sweater, narrow black slacks, and something else. A straight gleam of metal along the ground. It began beneath the clump of black hair and ran past the trunk of the trees into the grass. Bond slowly, wearily bent his head and looked at the ground between his spread hands. It was the girl, Tilly. She was watching the buildings below. She had a rifle that must have been among the innocent golf clubs, ready to fire on them. Damn and blast a silly bitch! Bond slowly relaxed. It didn't matter who she was or what she was up to. He measured the distance, planned each stride, the trajectory of the final spring, left hand to her neck, right to the gun. Now! Bond's chest skidded over the hump of the buttocks and thudded into the small of the girl's back. The impact emptied the breath out of her with a soft grunt. The fingers of Bond's left hand flew to the throat and found the carotid artery. His right hand was on the waist of the rifle's stock. He prized the fingers away, felt that the safety catch was on, and reached the rifle far to one side. Bond eased the weight of his chest off the girl's back and moved his fingers away from her neck. He closed them softly over her mouth. Beneath him, he felt the body heave, the lungs laboring for breath. She was still out. Carefully, Bond gathered the two hands behind the girl's back and held them with his right. Beneath him, the buttocks began to squirm. The legs jerked. Bond pinned the legs to the ground with his stomach and thighs, noting the strong muscles bunched under him. Now the breath was rasping through his fingers. Teeth gnawed at his hand. Bond inched carefully forwards along the girl. He got his mouth through her hair to her ear. He whispered urgently, "Tilly, for Christ's sake, stay still. This is me, Bond. I'm a friend. This is vital, something you don't know about. Will you stay still and listen?" The teeth stopped reaching for his fingers. The body relaxed and lay soft under his. After a time, the head nodded once. Bond slid off her. He lay beside her, still holding her hands prisoned behind her back. He whispered, "Get your breath. But tell me, were you after Goldfinger?" The pale face glanced sideways and away. The girl whispered fiercely into the ground, "I was going to kill him." Some girl Goldfinger had put in the family way. Bond let go her hands. She brought them up and rested her head on them. Her whole body shuddered with exhaustion and released nerves. The shoulders began to shake softly. Bond reached out a hand and smoothed her hair, quietly, rhythmically. His eyes carefully went over the peaceful, unchanged scene below. Unchanged? There was something. The radar thing on the cowl of the chimney. It wasn't going round any more. It had stopped, with its oblong mouth pointing in their direction. The fact had no significance for Bond. Now the girl wasn't crying any more. Bond nuzzled his mouth close to her ear. Her hair smelled of jasmine. He whispered, "Don't worry. I'm after him too. And I'm going to damage him far worse than you could have done. I've been sent after him by London. They want him. What did he do to you?" She whispered almost to herself, "He killed my sister. You knew her. Jill Masterton." Bond said fiercely, "What happened?" "He has a woman once a month. Jill told me this when she first took the job. He hypnotizes them. And then he paints them gold."
"Christ, why?"
"I don't know. Jill told me he's mad about gold. I suppose he sort of thinks he's sort of possessing gold. You know, marrying it. He gets some Korean servant to paint them. The man has to leave their backbones unpainted. Jill couldn't explain that. I found out it so they wouldn't die. If their bodies were completely covered with gold paint, the pores of the skin wouldn't be able to breathe. Then they'd die.
Afterwards they're washed down by the Korean with resin or something. Goldfinger gives them $1,000 and sends them away.
Bond saw the dreadful odd job with his pot of gold paint, Goldfinger's eyes gloating over the glistening statue, the fierce possession.
What happened to Jill?
She cabled me to come. She was in an emergency ward in a hospital in Miami. Goldfinger had thrown her out. She was dying. The doctors didn't know what was the matter. She told me what had happened to her, what he had done to her. She died the same night.
The girl's voice was dry, matter of fact.
When I got back to England, I went to Train, the skin specialist. He told me this business about the pores of the skin. It had happened to some cabaret girl who had to pose as a silver statue. He showed me details of the case and the autopsy. Then I knew what had happened to Jill. Goldfinger had had her painted all over. He had murdered her. It must have been out of revenge for going with you.
There was a pause. The girl said dully,
"She told me about you. She liked you. She told me if ever I met you, I was to give you this ring."
Bond closed his eyes tight, fighting with a wave of mental nausea. More death, more blood on his hands. This time as the result of a careless gesture, a piece of bravado that had led to 24 hours of ecstasy with a beautiful girl who had taken his fancy, and, in the end, rather more than his fancy. And this petty sideswipe at Goldfinger's ego had been returned by Goldfinger 1,000, a millionfold. "She left my employ." The flat words in the sunshine at Sandwich 2 days before. How Goldfinger must have enjoyed saying that. Bond's fingernails dug into the palms of his hands. By God, he'd pin this murder on Goldfinger if it was the last act of his life. As for himself, Bond knew the answer. This death he would not be able to excuse as being part of his job. This death he would have to live with. The girl was pulling at her finger, at the cladder ring, the entwined hands round the gold heart. She put her knuckle to her mouth. The ring came off. She held it up for Bond to take. The tiny gold circle, silhouetted against the trunk of the tree, glittered in the moonlight. The noise in Bond's ear was something between a hiss and a shrill whistle. There was a dry, twanging thud. The aluminium feathers of the steel arrow trembled like a hummingbird's wings in front of Bond's eyes. The shaft of the arrow straightened. The gold ring tinkled down the shaft until it reached the bark of the tree. Slowly, almost incuriously, Bond turned his head. 10 yards away, half in moonlight, half in shadow, the black, melon-headed figure crouched, its legs widely straddled in the judo stance. The left arm, thrust forward against the glinting semicircle of the bow, was straight as a duelist's. The right hand, holding the feathers of the second arrow, was rigid against the right cheek. Behind the head, the taut right elbow lanced back in frozen suspense. The silver tip of the second arrow pointed exactly between the two pale, raised profiles. Bond breathed the words, "Don't move an inch." Aloud he said, "Hello, odd job. Damn good shot." Oddjob jerked the tip of the arrow upwards. Bond got to his feet, shielding the girl. He said softly out of the corner of his mouth, "He mustn't see the rifle." He said to Oddjob, speaking casually, peaceably, "Nice place Mr. Goldfinger has here. Want to have a word with him sometime? Perhaps it's a bit late tonight. You might tell him I'll be along tomorrow." Bond said to the girl, "Come on, darling. We've had our walk in the woods. Time to get back to the hotel." He took a step away from Oddjob towards the fence. Oddjob stamped his forward foot. The point of the second arrow swung to the centre of Bond's stomach.
"Wang!"
Oddjob jerked his head sideways and downwards towards the house. "Oh, you think he'd like to see us now? All right. You don't think we'll be disturbing him? Come on, darling." Bond led the way to the left of the tree, away from the rifle that lay in the shadowed grass. As they went slowly down the hill, Bond talked softly to the girl, briefing her. "You're my girlfriend. I brought you out from England. Seem surprised and interested by our little adventure. We're in a tough spot. Don't try any tricks." Bond jerked back his head. "This man's a killer." the girl said angrily.
"If only you hadn't interfered."
"Same to you," said Bond shortly. He took it back.
"I'm sorry, Tilly.
Didn't mean that. But I don't think you could have got away with it."
"I had my plans. I'd have been over the frontier by midnight."
Bond didn't answer. Something had caught his eye. On top of the tall chimney, the oblong mouth of the radar thing was revolving again. It was that that had spotted them, heard them. It must be some kind of sonic detector. What a bag of tricks this man was. Bond hadn't meant to underestimate Goldfinger. Had he managed to do so, decisively? Perhaps if he had had his gun. No. Bond knew that even his split-second draw wouldn't have beaten the Korean, wouldn't do so now. There was a total deadliness about this man. Whether Bond had been armed or unarmed, it would have been a man fighting a tank. They reached the courtyard. As they did so, the back door of the house opened. Two more Koreans, who might have been the servants from Recalva, ran out towards them through the warm splash of electric light. They carried ugly-looking polished sticks. "Stop!" Both men wore the savage, empty grin that men from Station J, who had been in Japanese prison camps, had described to Bond. "We search! No trouble, or—" The man who had spoken cut the air with a whistling lash of his stick. "Hands up!" Bond put his hands slowly up. He said to the girl, "Don't react. Whatever they do." Oddjob came forward and stood menacingly, watching the search. The search was expert. Bond coldly watched the hands on the girl, the grinning faces.
"Okay, come!"
They were herded through the open door and along a stone-flagged passage to the narrow entrance hall at the front of the house. The house smelled as Bond had imagined it would, musty and fragrant and summery. There were white-panelled doors. Oddjob knocked on one of them.
"Yes?"
Oddjob opened the door. They were prodded through. Goldfinger sat at a big desk. It was neatly encumbered with important-looking papers. The desk was flanked by grey metal filing cabinets. Beside the desk, within reach of Goldfinger's hand, stood a shortwave wireless set on a low table. There was an operator's keyboard and a machine that ticked busily and looked like a barograph. Bond guessed that this had something to do with the detector that had intercepted them. Goldfinger wore his purple velvet smoking jacket over an open-necked white silk shirt. The open neck showed a tuft of orange chest hair. He sat very erect in a high-backed chair. He hardly glanced at the girl. The big china-blue eyes were fixed on Bond. They showed no surprise. They held no expression except a piercing hardness. Bond blustered. "Look here, Goldfinger. What the hell's all this about? You put the police onto me over that $10,000, and I got on your tracks with my girlfriend here, Miss Soames. I've come to find out what the hell you mean by it. We climbed the fence. I know it's trespassing, but I wanted to catch you before you moved on somewhere else. Then this ape of yours came along and damn near killed one of us with his bow and arrow. Two more of your bloody Koreans held us up and searched us. What the hell's going on? If you can't give me a civil answer and full apologies, I'll put the police on you." Goldfinger's flat, hard stare didn't flicker. He might not have heard Bond's angry gentleman's outburst. The finely chiselled lips parted. He said,
"Mr. Bond, they have a saying in Chicago. Once is happenstance, twice is coincidence. The third time, it's enemy action. Miami, Sandwich, and now Geneva. I propose to wring the truth out of you."
Goldfinger's eyes slid slowly past Bond's head.
"Oddjob, the pressure room."
Part 3. Enemy Action. Chapter 15. The Pressure Room. Bond's reaction was automatic. There was no reason behind it. He took one quick step forward and hurled himself across the desk at Goldfinger. His body, launched in a shallow dive, hit the top of the desk and ploughed through the litter of papers. There was a heavy thud as the top of his head crashed into Goldfinger's breastbone. The momentum of the blow rocked Goldfinger in his chair. Bond kicked back at the edge of the desk, got a purchase, and rammed forward again. As the chair toppled backwards and the two bodies went down in the splintering woodwork, Bond's fingers got to the throat and his thumbs went into its base and downwards with every ounce of his force. Then the whole house fell on Bond. A balk of timber hit him at the base of the neck, and he rolled sluggishly off Goldfinger onto the floor and lay still. The vortex of light through which Bond was whirling slowly flattened into a disk, a yellow moon, and then into a burning cyclops eye. Something was written round the fiery eyeball. It was a message, an important message for him. He must read it. Carefully, one by one, Bond spelled out the tiny letters. The message said, Société Anonyme Mazda. What was its significance? A hard bolt of water hit Bond in the face. The water stung his eyes and filled his mouth. He retched desperately and tried to move. He couldn't. His eyes cleared and his brain. There was a throbbing pain at the back of his neck. He was staring up into a big enameled light bulb with one powerful bulb. He was on some sort of a table, and his wrists and ankles were bound to its edges. He felt with his fingers. He felt polished metal. A voice, Goldfinger's voice, flat, uninterested, said, "Now we can begin." Bond turned his head towards the voice. His eyes were dazzled by the light. He squeezed them hard and opened them. Goldfinger was sitting in a canvas chair. He had taken off his jacket and was in his shirt sleeves. There were red marks round the base of his throat. On a folding table beside him were various tools and metal instruments and a control panel. On the other side of the table, Tilly Masterton sat in another chair. She was strapped to it by her wrists and ankles. She sat bolt upright as if she was in school. She looked incredibly beautiful, but shocked, remote. Her eyes gazed vacantly at Bond. She was either drugged or hypnotized. Bond turned his head to the right. A few feet away stood the Korean. He still wore his bowler hat, but now he was stripped to the waist. The yellow skin of his huge torso glinted with sweat. There was no hair on it. The flat pectoral muscles were as broad as dinner plates, and the stomach was concave below the great arch of the ribs. The biceps and forearms, also hairless, were as thick as thighs. The 10 minutes to two oil slicks of the eyes looked pleased, greedy. The mouthful of blackish teeth formed an oblong grin of anticipation. Bond raised his head. The quick look round hurt. They were in one of the factory workrooms. White light blazed round the iron doors of two electric furnaces. There were bluish sheets of metal stacked in wooden frames. From somewhere came the whir of a generator. There was a distant, muffled sound of hammering, and behind the sound, the faraway iron pant of the power plant. Bond glanced down the table on which he lay spread-eagled. He let his head fall back with a sigh. There was a narrow slit down the centre of the polished steel table. At the far end of the slit, like a foresight framed in the V of his parted feet, were the glinting teeth of a circular saw. Bond lay and stared up at the little message on the lamp bulb. Goldfinger began to speak in a relaxed, conversational voice. Bond pulled the curtains tight across the ghastly peep-show of his imagination and listened.
"Mr. Bond, the word pain comes from the Latin poena, meaning penalty, that which must be paid. You must now pay for the inquisitiveness which your attack upon me proves, as I suspected, to be inimical. Curiosity, as they say, killed the cat. This time it will have to kill two cats, for I fear I must also count this girl an enemy. She tells me she is staying at the Berg. One telephone call proved that to be false. Odd Job was sent to where you were both hidden, and recovered her rifle, and also a ring which it happens that I recognize. Under hypnotism the rest came out. This girl came here to kill me. Perhaps you did too. You have both failed. Now must come the poena. Mr. Bond," the voice was weary, bored, "I have had many enemies in my time. I am very successful, and immensely rich, and riches, if I may inflict another of my aphorisms upon you, may not make you friends, but they greatly increase the class and variety of your enemies."
"That's very neatly put."
Goldfinger ignored the interruption.
"If you were a free man, with your talent for inquiry, you would be able to find round the world the relics of those who have wished me ill, or who have tried to thwart me. There have, as I said, been many of these people, and you would find, Mr. Bond, that their remains resemble those of hedgehogs squashed upon the roads in summertime."
"Very poetic simile."
"By chance, Mr. Bond. I am a poet in deeds, not often in words. I am concerned to arrange my actions in appropriate and effective patterns, but that is by the way. I wish to convey to you that it was a most evil day for you when you first crossed my path and, admittedly in a very minor fashion, thwarted a minuscule project upon which I was engaged. On that occasion, it was someone else who suffered the poena that should have been meted out to you. An eye was taken for the eye, but it was not yours. You were lucky, and if you had then found an oracle to consult, the oracle would have said to you, 'Mr. Bond, you have been fortunate. Keep away from Mr. Auric Goldfinger. He is a most powerful man. If Mr. Goldfinger wanted to crush you, he would only have to turn over in his sleep to do so.'"
"You express yourself most vividly." Bond turned his head. The great brown and orange football of a head was bent slightly forward. The round moon face was bland, indifferent. Casually, one hand reached out to the control panel and pressed down a switch. There came a slow, metallic growl from the end of the table on which Bond lay. It curved quickly up to a harsh whine, and then to a shrill, high whistle that was barely audible. Bond turned his head wearily away. How soon could he manage to die? Was there any way he could hasten death? A friend of his had survived the Gestapo. He had described to Bond how he had tried to commit suicide by holding his breath. By superhuman willpower, after a few minutes without breathing, unconsciousness had come. But, with the blackout of the senses, will and intention had also left the body. At once reason was forgotten. The body's instinct to live manned the pumps and got breath back into the body again. But Bond could try it. There was nothing else to help him through the pain barrier before the blessing of death. For death was the only exit. He knew he could never squeal to Goldfinger and live with himself again, even in the unlikely event that Goldfinger could be bought off with the truth. No, he must stick to his thin story, and hope that the others who would now follow him on Goldfinger's trail would have better luck. Who would M choose? Probably 008, the second killer in the small section of three. He was a good man, more careful than Bond. M would know that Goldfinger had killed Bond, and he would give 008 license to kill in return. 258 in Geneva would put him onto the scent that would end with Bond's inquiry about the Enterprise's auric. Yes, fate would catch up with Goldfinger if Bond could only keep his mouth shut. If he gave the least clue away, Goldfinger would escape. That was unthinkable.
"Now then, Mr. Bond," Goldfinger's voice was brisk, "enough of these amiabilities. Sing, as my Chicago friends put it, and you will die quickly and painlessly. The girl also. Sing not, and your death will be one long scream. The girl I shall then give to Oddjob, as I did that cat, for supper. Which is it to be?"
Bond said, "Don't be a fool, Goldfinger. I told my friends at Universal where I was going and why. The girl's parents know that she went with me. I made inquiries about this factory of yours before we came here. We shall be traced here very easily. Universal is powerful. You will have the police after you within days of our disappearance. I will make a deal with you. Let us go, and nothing more will be heard of the matter. I will vouch for the girl. You are making a stupid mistake. We are two perfectly innocent people."
Goldfinger said in a bored voice, "I'm afraid you don't understand, Mr. Bond. Whatever you have managed to find out about me, which I suspect is very little, can only be a grain of the truth. I am engaged upon gigantic enterprises. To take the gamble of letting either of you leave here alive would be quite ludicrous. It is out of the question. As for my being bothered by the police, I shall be delighted to receive them if they come. Those of my Koreans who can speak won't do so, nor will the mouths of my electric furnaces, which will have vaporized you both and all your belongings at 2,000 degrees centigrade. No, Mr. Bond, make your choice. Perhaps I can encourage you.
There came the noise of a lever moving across iron teeth.
The saw is now approaching your body at about 1 inch every minute. Meanwhile,
he glanced at Oddjob and held up one finger,
"a little massage from Oddjob. To begin with, only grade 1. Grades 2 and 3 are still more persuasive."
Bond closed his eyes. The sickly zoo smell of Oddjob enveloped him. Big, rasping fingers set to work on him, carefully, delicately. A pressure here, combined with a pressure there, a sudden squeeze, a pause, and then a quick, sharp blow. Always the hard hands were surgically accurate. Bond ground his teeth until he thought they would break. The sweat of pain began to form pools in the sockets of his closed eyes. The shrill whine of the saw was getting louder. It reminded Bond of the sawdust-scented sounds of long-ago summer evenings at home in England. Home? This was his home. This cocoon of danger he had chosen to live in. And here he would be buried in some corner of a foreign blast furnace that is forever 2,000 degrees centigrade. God rest ye, merry gentlemen of the Secret Service. What should he give himself as an epitaph? What should be his famous last words? That you have no choice about your birth, but you can choose the way you die? Yes, it would look well on a tombstone. Not savoir vivre, but savoir mourir.
Mr. Bond,
Goldfinger's voice held an ounce of urgency.
Is this really necessary? Just tell me the truth. Who are you? Who sent you here? What do you know? Then it will be so easy. You shall both have a pill. There will be no pain. It will be like taking a sleeping draught. Otherwise it will be so messy and distressing. And are you being fair to the girl? Is this the behaviour of an English gentleman?
Oddjob's torment had stopped. Bond turned his head slowly towards the voice and opened his eyes. He said,
Goldfinger, there is nothing more to tell, because there is nothing. If you will not accept my first bargain, I will make you another. The girl and I will work for you. How about that? We are capable people. You could put us to good use. And get a knife? 2 knives in my back? Thank you, no, Mr. Bond.
Bond decided it was time to stop talking. It was time to start winding up the mainspring of willpower that must not run down again until he was dead. Bond said politely,
Then you can go and blank yourself.
He expelled all the breath from his lungs and closed his eyes.
Even I am not capable of that, Mr. Bond, said Goldfinger with good humour. And now, since you have chosen the stony path instead of the smooth, I must extract what interest I can from your predicament by making the path as stony as possible. Oddjob, grade 2.
The lever on the table moved across iron teeth. Now Bond could feel the wind of the saw between his knees. The hands came back. Bond counted the slowly pounding pulse that utterly possessed his body. It was like the huge panting power plant in the other part of the factory, but, in his case, it was slowly decelerating. If only it would slow down quicker. What was this ridiculous will to live that refused to listen to the brain? Who was making the engine run on, although the tank was dry of fuel? But he must empty his mind of thought, as well as his body of oxygen. He must become a vacuum, a deep hole of unconsciousness. Still the light burned red through his eyelids. Still he could feel the bursting pressure in his temples, still the slow drum of life beat in his ears. A scream tried to force its way through the clamped teeth. "Die, damn you, die! Die, damn you, die! Damn you, die! Damn you, die! Damn you, die!"
Chapter 16. The Last and the Biggest. The wings of a dove, the heavenly choir. Hark, the herald angels sing. What else ought he to remember about paradise? It was all so exactly like what he had been told in the nursery, this sensation of flying, the darkness, the drone of a million harps. He really must try and remember the dope about the place. Let's see now. One got to the pearly gates. A deep, fatherly voice said, almost in his ear, "This is your captain speaking." Well, well, who was this? St. Peter? "We are coming in to land now. Will you please fasten your seat belts and extinguish your cigarettes? Thank you." There must be a whole lot of them, going up together. Would Tilly be on the same trip? Bond squirmed with embarrassment. How would he introduce her to the others? To Vespa, for instance. And when it came to the point, which would he like the best? But perhaps it would be a big place, with countries and towns. There was probably no more reason why he should run into one of his former girlfriends here than there had been on Earth. But still, there were a lot of people he'd better avoid until he got settled in and found out the form. Perhaps, with so much love about, these things wouldn't matter. Perhaps one just loved all the girls one met. Tricky business. With these unworthy thoughts in his mind, Bond relapsed into unconsciousness. The next thing he knew was a gentle sensation of swaying. He opened his eyes. The sun blinded them. He closed them again. A voice above and behind his head said, "Watch it, bud! That ramp's steeper than it looks!" Almost immediately there was a heavy jolt. A surly voice in front said, "Jesus, you're telling me! Why in hell can't they put down rubber?" Bond thought angrily, "That's a fine way to talk up here. Just because I'm new and they think no one's listening." There was the bang of a swing door. Something hit Bond sharply on a protruding elbow. He shouted, "Hey!" and tried to reach his elbow and rub it, but his hands wouldn't move.
"What do you know? Hey, Sam, better call the doc. This one's come round." "Sure. Here, put him alongside the other."
Bond felt himself being lowered. It was cooler now. He opened his eyes. A big, round Brooklyn face was bent over his. The eyes met his and smiled. The metal supports of the stretcher touched the ground. The man said,
"How you feeling, mister?"
"Where am I?" Now there was panic in Bond's voice. He tried to rise, but couldn't. He felt the sweat break out on his body. God, was this still part of the old life? At the thought of it, a wave of grief poured through his body. Tears burned his eyes and trickled down his cheeks.
"Hey, hey, take it easy, mister. You're okay. This is Idlewild, New York. You're in America now. No more troubles, see?"
The man straightened up. He thought Bond was a refugee from somewhere.
"Sam, get moving! This guy's in shock! Okay, okay!"
The two voices receded, mumbling anxiously. Bond found he could move his head. He looked round. He was in a white-painted ward, presumably something to do with the health department of the airport. There was a row of tidy beds. Sun poured down from high windows, but it was cool, air-conditioned. He was on a stretcher on the floor. There was another one next to it. He strained his head sideways. It was Tilly. She was unconscious. Her pale face, framed in the black hair, pointed at the ceiling. The door at the end of the ward sighed open. A doctor in a white coat stood and held it. Goldfinger, looking brisk, cheerful, walked swiftly down between the beds. He was followed by Oddjob. Bond wearily closed his eyes. Christ, so that was the score. Feet gathered round his stretcher. Goldfinger said breezily,
"Well, they certainly look in good shape, eh, Doctor? That's one of the blessings of having enough money. When one's friends or one's staff are ill, one can get them the very best medical attention. Nervous breakdowns, both of them, and in the same week. Would you believe it? But I blame myself for working them both too hard. Now it's my duty to get them back on their feet again. Dr. Foch, he's the best man in Geneva, by the way, was quite definite. He said, 'They need rest, Mr. Goldfinger. Rest, rest, and again rest.' He gave them sedatives, and now they're on their way to the Harkness Pavilion at the Presbyterian."
Goldfinger chuckled fatly.
"So, and you shall reap, eh, Doctor? When I gave the Harkness $1 million worth of X-ray equipment, I certainly never expected anything back. But now, I only had to put through a call, and they got two fine rooms waiting for them. Now then."
There was a rustle of notes.
"Thank you for all your help with immigration. Fortunately, they both had valid visas, and I think immigration was satisfied that Mr. Orrick Goldfinger was a sufficient guarantee that neither of them wants to overthrow the United States government by force. What?"
"Yes, indeed. And thank you, Mr. Goldfinger. Anything I can do? I understand you have a private ambulance waiting outside." Bond opened his eyes and looked at where the doctor's voice came from. He saw a pleasant, serious young man with rimless glasses and a crew cut. Bond said quietly and with desperate sincerity, "Doctor, there is absolutely nothing wrong with me or this girl. We have been drugged and brought here against our will. Neither of us works or has ever worked for Goldfinger. I am warning you that we have been kidnapped. I demand to see the Chief of Immigration. I have friends in Washington and New York. They will vouch for me. I beg of you to believe me."
Bond held the man's eyes in his, willing him to believe. The doctor looked worried. He turned to Goldfinger. Goldfinger shook his head, discreetly so that Bond would not be insulted. A surreptitious hand went up and tapped the side of his head away from Bond. Goldfinger raised helpless eyebrows.
"You see what I mean, Doctor. It's been like this for days. Total nervous prostration combined with persecution mania. Dr. Foch said they often go together. It may need weeks at the Harkness. But I'm going to pull him round if it's the last thing I do. It's the shock of these unfamiliar surroundings. Perhaps a shot of intravenous sodium?"
The doctor bent to his black bag. "I guess you're right, Mr. Goldfinger. So long as Harkness is looking after the case..." There came the tinkle of instruments. Goldfinger said,
"It's terribly sad to see a man break down so utterly. A man who has been one of my best assistants."
He bent a sweet, fatherly smile on Bond. There was a catch in his voice.
"You'll be all right, James. Just relax and have a nice sleep. I was afraid the flight might be too much for you. Just relax and leave everything to me."
Bond felt the swab on his arm. He heaved. Against his will, a shower of curses poured from his lips. Then he felt the needle and opened his mouth and screamed while the doctor knelt beside him and delicately, patiently, wiped away the sweat from his forehead. Now it was a grey, painted box of a room. There were no windows. Light came from a single bowl lamp inset in the centre of the ceiling. Round the lamp were concentric slits in the plaster, and there was the neutral smell and faint hum of air conditioning. Bond found he could sit up. He did so. He felt drowsy, but well. He suddenly realized that he was ravenously hungry and thirsty. When had he last had a meal? 2, 3 days ago? He put his feet down on the floor. He was naked. He examined his body. Oddjob had been careful. There was no sign of damage, save for the group of needle marks on his right forearm. He got up, conquering dizziness, and took a few steps in the room. He had been lying on a ship's type bunk with drawers under it. The only other furniture in the room was a plain deal table and an upright wooden chair. Everything was clean, functional, Spartan. Bond knelt to the drawers under the bunk and opened them. They contained all the contents of his suitcase, except his watch and the gun. Even the rather heavy shoes he had been wearing on his expedition to Enterprise's Oryk were there. He twisted one of the heels and pulled. The broad, double-sided knife slid smoothly out of its scabbard in the sole. With the fingers wrapped round the locked heel, it made a workmanlike stabbing dagger. Bond verified that the other shoe held its knife and clicked the heels back into position. He pulled out some clothes and put them on. He found his cigarette case and lighter and lit a cigarette. There were two doors, of which one had a handle. He opened this one. It led into a small, well-appointed bathroom and lavatory. His washing and shaving things were neatly laid out. There were a girl's things beside them. Bond softly opened the other door into the bathroom. It was a similar room to his own. Tilly Masterton's black hair showed on the pillow of the bunk. Bond tiptoed over and looked down. She was sleeping peacefully, a half-smile on the beautiful mouth. Bond went back into the bathroom, softly closed the door and went to the mirror over the basin and looked at himself. The black stubble looked more like 3 days than two. He set to work to clean himself up. Half an hour later, Bond was sitting on the edge of his bunk, thinking, when the door without a handle opened abruptly. Oddjob stood in the entrance. He looked incuriously at Bond. His eyes flickered carefully round the room. Bond said sharply, "Oddjob, I want a lot of food, quickly, and a bottle of bourbon, soda and ice. Also a carton of Chesterfields, king size, and either my own watch or another one as good as mine. Quick march! Chop, chop! And tell Goldfinger I want to see him, but not until I've had something to eat. Come on, jump to it. Don't stand there looking inscrutable. I'm hungry." Oddjob looked redly at Bond as if wondering which piece to break. He opened his mouth, uttered a noise between an angry bark and a belch, spat dryly on the floor at his feet, and stepped back, whirling the door shut. When the slam should have come, the door decelerated abruptly and closed with a soft, decisive double click. The encounter put Bond in good humour. For some reason, Goldfinger had decided against killing them. He wanted them alive. Soon Bond would know why he wanted them alive, but so long as he did, Bond intended to stay alive on his own terms. Those terms included putting Oddjob and any other Korean firmly in his place, which in Bond's estimation was rather lower than apes in the mammalian hierarchy. By the time an excellent meal, together with everything else, including his watch, Bond had asked for, had been brought by one of the Korean servants, Bond had learned nothing more about his circumstances, except that his room was close to water and not far from a railway bridge. Assuming his room was in New York, it was either on the Hudson or the East River. The railway was electric and sounded like a subway, but Bond's New York geography was not good enough to place it. His watch had stopped. When he asked the time, he got no answer. Bond had eaten all the food on the tray and was smoking and sipping a solid bourbon and soda when the door opened. Goldfinger came in alone. He was wearing a regulation businessman's clothes and looked relaxed and cheerful. He closed the door behind him and stood with his back to it. He looked searchingly at Bond. Bond smoked and looked politely back. Goldfinger said, "Good morning, Mr. Bond. I see you are yourself again. I hope you prefer being here to being dead. So as to save you the trouble of asking a lot of conventional questions, I will tell you where you are and what has happened to you. I will then put to you a proposition to which I require an unequivocal reply. You are a more reasonable man than most, so I need only give you one brief warning. Do not attempt any dramatics. Do not attack me with a knife or a fork or that bottle. If you do, I shall shoot you with this." A small caliber pistol grew like a black thumb out of Goldfinger's right fist. He put the hand with the gun back in his pocket. "I very seldom use these things. When I have had to, I have never needed more than one 2.5 caliber bullet to kill. I shoot at the right eye, Mr. Bond, and I never miss." Bond said, "Don't worry. I'm not as accurate as that with a bourbon bottle." He hitched up the knee of his trousers and put one leg across the other. He sat relaxed. "Go ahead."
"Mr. Bond."
Goldfinger's voice was amiable.
"I am an expert in many other materials beside metals, and I have a keen appreciation of everything that is 1,000 fine, as we say of the purest gold. In comparison with that degree of purity, of value, human material is of a very low grade indeed. But occasionally one comes across a piece of this stuff that can at least be put to the lower forms of use. Oddjob is an example of what I mean. Simple, unrefined clay, capable of limited exploitation. At the last moment, my hand hesitated to destroy a utensil with the durability I observed in yourself. I may have made a mistake in staying my hand. In any case, I shall take the fullest steps to protect myself from the consequences of my impulse. It was something you said that saved your life. You suggested that you and Miss Masterton would work for me.
Normally I would have no use for either of you, but it just happens that I am on the brink of a certain enterprise in which the services of both of you could be of a certain minimal assistance. So I took the gamble. I gave you both the necessary sedatives. Your bills were paid, and your things fetched from the Berg, where Miss Masterton turned out to be registered under her real name. I sent a cable in your name to Universal Export. You had been offered employment in Canada. You were flying over to explore the prospects. You were taking Miss Masterton as your secretary. You would write further details. A clumsy cable, but it will serve for the short period I require your services.
It won't, thought Bond, unless you included in the text one of the innocent phrases that would tell M that the cable was authentic. By now the service would know he was working under enemy control. Wheels would be turning very fast indeed.
And in case you think, Mr. Bond, that my precautions were inadequate, that you will be traced, let me tell you that I am no longer in the least interested about your true identity, nor the strength and resources of your employers. You and Miss Masterton have utterly disappeared, Mr. Bond. So have I. So have all my staff. The airport will refer inquiries to the Harkness Pavilion at the Presbyterian Hospital. The hospital will never have heard of Mr. Goldfinger, nor of his patients. The FBI and the CIA have no record of me, for I have no criminal history. No doubt the immigration authorities will have details of my comings and goings over the years, but these will not be helpful. As for my present whereabouts and yours, Mr. Bond, we are now in the warehouse of the High Speed Trucking Corporation, a formerly respectable concern which I own through nominees and which has been equipped most thoroughly as the secret headquarters for the enterprise of which I spoke. You and Miss Masterton will be confined to these quarters. Here you will live and work, and possibly, though personally I have doubts about Miss Masterton's inclinations in that respect, make love.
And what will our work consist of?
Mr. Bond.
For the first time since Bond had known Goldfinger, the big, bland face, always empty of expression, showed a trace of life. A look almost of rapture illuminated the eyes. The finely chiselled lips pursed into a thin, beatific curve.
Mr. Bond, all my life I have been in love. I have been in love with gold. I love its colour, its brilliance, its divine heaviness. I love the texture of gold, that soft sliminess that I have learnt to gauge so accurately by touch that I can estimate the fineness of a bar to within 1 carat. And I love the warm tang it exudes when I melt it down into a true golden syrup. But above all, Mr. Bond, I love the power that gold alone gives to its owner, the magic of controlling energy, exacting labour, fulfilling one's every wish and whim, and, when need be, purchasing bodies, minds, even souls. Yes, Mr. Bond, I have worked all my life for gold, and in return gold has worked for me and for those enterprises that I have espoused. I ask you,
Goldfinger gazed earnestly at Bond,
is there any other substance on earth that so rewards its owner?
Many people have become rich and powerful without possessing an ounce of the stuff, but I see your point. How much have you managed to collect, and what do you do with it?
I own about £20 million worth, about as much as a small country. It is now all in New York. I keep it where I need it. My treasure of gold is like a compost heap. I move it here and there over the face of the earth, and, wherever I choose to spread it, that corner blossoms and blooms. I reap the harvest and move on. At this moment I am proposing to encourage, to force, a certain American enterprise with my golden compost. Therefore the gold bars are in New York.
How do you choose these enterprises? What attracts you to them?
I espouse any enterprise that will increase my stock of gold. I invest. I smuggle. I steal.
Goldfinger made a small gesture of the hands, opening the palms persuasively.
"If you will follow the simile, regard history as a train speeding along through time. Birds and animals are disturbed by the noise and tumult of the train's passage. They fly away from it, or run fearfully, or cower, thinking they hide. I am like the hawk that follows the train. You have no doubt seen them doing this, in Greece, for instance. Ready to pounce on anything that may be flushed by the train's passage, by the passage of history. To give you a simple example, the progress of history produces a man who invents penicillin. At the same time, history creates a world war. Many people are dying, or afraid of dying. Penicillin will save them. Through bribery at certain military establishments on the continent, I obtain stocks of penicillin. I water these down with some harmless powder or liquid, and sell them at immense profit to those who crave the stuff. You see what I mean, Mr. Bond? You have to wait for the prey, watch it carefully, and then pounce. But, as I say, I do not search out such enterprises. I allow the train of history to flush them towards me.
What's the latest one? What have Miss Masterton and I got to do with it?
The latest one, Mr. Bond, is the last one. It is also the biggest.
Goldfinger's eyes were now blank, focused inwards. His voice became low, almost reverential at what he saw.
Man has climbed Everest, and he has scraped the depths of the ocean. He has fired rockets into outer space and split the atom. He has invented, devised, created in every realm of human endeavor, and everywhere he has triumphed, broken records, achieved miracles. I said in every realm, but there is one that has been neglected, Mr. Bond. That one is the human activity loosely known as crime.
This book is continued on Disc 6.